This is PPD. You guys are watching Thorin's YouTube channel. One of the only men with a bigger ego than even myself.
Right, I'm here for another episode of Reflections, and my guest for this one is going to be Owie 2000, who is a multiple-time TI champion now, because he just won it as a coach, and he won it as a player back in the day with EG. And in fact, I think that's actually where we should start this interview, because the interesting thing is, I think your interview might even have been my first interview I did in Dota. Like, I'm not sure. I might have done one with, like, a caster or something that I was friends with at the time. But I remember at the time when I did this interview, for me, it was actually a banger, because it was right after you basically won TI in 2015. Then that, because EG's the ultimate drama team, everyone knows. Then just got kicked straight afterwards, even though it's like, what? Because obviously Lord Arteezy was coming back to EG, and everyone knows. It's the Arteezy's world, and we just live in it, innit? Except for TI, of course. But anyway, that's by the by. So he came back, and there was a big drama. And at the time, I just thought, what a banger opportunity to do an interview. Because one, you have just won the world championship. And then two, I'm sure you've got some interesting thoughts. But one thing I wanted to ask as we do this interview now, so if anyone wants to watch that old one, it is way, way, way back in the day. But we go pretty in-depth. We go to all the finals and TI and everything. But I actually want to, like, rewind the clock to that moment again, because it's so many years later now. It's 7 years later, Owie. And you've even won TI again. You've been in all different teams. You've even played against Arteezy. Let me ask the question that at the time maybe you couldn't answer, which is, if you look back now, wasn't it a bit messed up the way they kicked you off the Evil Geniuses? Like, here's the thing, even if they kick you out, shouldn't you sort of get like a grace period to show if you could be good or keep winning or something?
I think Dota's sort of weird in esports, because in most other games, I think it's less like drastic how hard you need to win. Like, Dota's all about winning.
Okay.
Like, a lot of players, they don't do interviews, they don't do media, they don't tweet, they don't do content. It's all based on their performance in game. It's just because of the structure of the scene around TI and how big the prize pool is compared to how much your sponsors give you and stuff. But looking back, like, honestly, like, I still think it'll be very hard for them to not take Arteezy, because back then what happened is, like, they took a star player from their biggest competitor to their own team, so they were like eliminating a big competitor while, sure, you know, hypothetically bolstering their own roster. I think, like, with hindsight, maybe, like I think teams have learned a lot more about team synergy, and I think the thing about EG was that how my knowledge base was very different than the other players. Like, the stuff I was good at was very different, so it ended up syncing up very well, and that's something that I think they never really were able to replicate. So I mean, the kick probably shouldn't have happened at the end, you know? If you win TI, you probably shouldn't kick someone, but it is what it is.
Because one thing I just wanted to follow up on there that I always thought was a bit whack about it was, like, what made that run for EG, the rest of the players, so cool was obviously the fact that, like, they were actually supposed to be the team left for dead when Arteezy left and made the secret super team, and it was supposed to be secret that it was going to win TI, not EG. And obviously, even when they won the Dota Asia Championships, PPD did that epic tweet where it was like, you know, one more championship, one less ego. It was fire. Look, the drama was fire. But the problem I have with that angle is, like, I actually thought that was a really good narrative. Like, it made a lot of sense. The team thought, like, his ego was too big or whatever, he left. But then when they just let him come back like that, it was like, what was all that about then, guys? Like, what the hell? It's a secret. You just wish he'd stayed. Like, what? Didn't you feel like that?
Yeah, and after that, I think that season, he went to secret, where I actually ended up coaching him in 2016 for TI6. That wasn't a good run.
Yes.
But, and, like, I think Dota's, like, it's so weird, because if the only thing that matters is your performance, then people will do, like, they're willing to forgive anything, you know? As long as they think it gives them a better chance of winning, because this is the only thing that matters in Dota. There's no, like, I don't know, like, of the top players right now, I think, like, maybe Saberlight and Thompson stream, and not that regularly, to be honest, when there's competition, and there's no one else that's, like, a high pro player. Maybe some of the Eastern European players, but I think that's pretty much it. Like, it doesn't really matter what's happened. If you think a move gives you the best chance to win, and this is a bit in the past, like, I think teams have learned from it, but if back then, if you thought a team gave you a better chance to win, you would just do it. Right now, I think there's a lot more emphasis on synergy. We saw a few, like, super teams sort of fail. One of those, as I mentioned, was a 2016 secret. But also, like, with the rise of OG, we watched two true sites with them, where they took, like, players who are, like, I don't know, I feel like in some of the first true sites, they were having, like, a lot of, like, mental issues and stuff, but they were able to rally each other because they behaved as a team, as a group of, like, professional individuals who helped each other, and that made the team synergy aspect go up in value a lot in Dota. And now I don't think you can win these big tournaments without being an actual team.
Along those lines, then, here's what annoys me, right, is loads of people who don't follow Dota 2, you'll probably have heard this, they still think, no joke, that this is like 2013 or something, and TI is like all that matters, and the rest of the tournament's almost like a warm-up for that, right? Even though I've tried to explain to them, like, dude, DPC's been huge for years, there's millions and millions, like, the majors have been, I mean, the joke is OG was winning majors before they won TI, it's how they established themselves, you know. There is a circuit, but the problem is, what you're talking about is sort of like the trend that runs one every TI, like, even if a team finishes third, there's probably a shuffle after TI. Dude, even if you win TI, people do shuffles, and the Chinese team's obviously notorious for, like, half of them retire and then come back 6 months later, a different team. Is there in Dota to you? Because I know a lot of people who were Dota 2 pros, then they didn't just come along in Dota 2. Some people have been playing Dota since the 2000s, where it was a tiny little game. Is there, do you think for top players in Dota, like, it is kind of like, I've got to win the TI at some point in my career? Like, it's worth gambling anything for that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a circuit and there's majors, but they're sort of small compared to TI. Like, I mean, this TI was a lot smaller than last year's TI, yes, in terms of prize pool. It's like from 40 to 18 or whatever. But TI is still where all the money is and all the prestige. Like, these majors, they're, it's not like they're small tournaments in the grand scheme of things, but everything gets made small compared to TI. Like, even this TI, I think a lot of, honestly, more the crowd than the players, but probably the players too, like, they're like, oh, this TI is so much smaller than last TI. It's still like an $18 or $19 million tournament. Like, that's insanely ridiculous.
If you don't know, in Counter-Strike, ours is $1 million for the major deal.
Yeah. No, because it's absurd, right? But when you compare it to last year's TI of $40 million, like, you can understand. Like, it's like you gave a kid some candy and you took it away, right? You never give the kid candy if you're like, holy shit, $18, $19 million tournament? Like, that's insane. But, you know. But regarding your question, like, no, it's still all about TI, I think. Like, the DPC and the majors, they're basically just TI qualifiers. We recently had the Saudi tournament. I think that was the first tournament outside of TI that had a really large prize pool since, like, the 2016 majors, where they were, like, I think 3 million or something. I can't remember. But the year they had three majors that were big with the Shanghai year. But, yeah. TI's where it's at.
After Evil Geniuses, well, very fair you'd say that now. Obviously, you just won it again, so to be fair, you have to say that in some ways. Right, after the EG period, you obviously went to, like, when I say you went to the Digital Chaos team, people are going to get really hyped. Like, forget the years. Like, oh my God, the one that comes second at it. No, calm down. This is a different one. This is way before that. And actually, it's way before that team even was recognized as really great. And you were playing with a bunch of people back then who, this is one of these ones where if you look at this roster now, dude, this roster looks amazing, but it's just too far back, wasn't it? Like, these are all players who become, like, top players and have success at big tournaments. Why did this lineup not really work out, the one where it was like Resolution and Bulber and you guys? Like, it seems like on paper, like I say, it looks like maybe it was ahead of its time or something.
Okay, so first of all, I think after TF5 EG, which I got kicked, my biggest regret was, like, not taking a break. I think my mental was really not in a good spot after that, for sort of obvious reasons. The second thing is, like, how EG functioned. They're really business-like, right? We didn't actually talk about Dota that much as a team. It was more of, like, a collection of, like, really high-skilled players who just, like, sort of combined and synced up in the game, not so much outside the game. And we had some Sumail who just, he was, like, three levels better than every other player in the tournament, so we won TI off him, basically. But most of my ideas I learned were on C9, like, the year before that. And then when I came from playing on C9 and EG, who are, like, a team that was very, very high skill with the players, a lot of individual ideas and stuff. But when I went to form a new team, I feel like I was actually having to, like, relearn or teach a lot of things that were more rudimentary to me. So it was hard, like, to sync up. And then, like, I think I, as a player, I put a lot of pressure on my teammates, right? Because I just came off some TI win. But it's not like in Dota, especially, like, you're not going to win alone, and you need to, like, get your teammates at the level where...
Did you have the vibe, though? Like, that's also why I have to, like, succeed, because everyone's expecting it, because I'm just being an EG and I've got to, like, show everyone I'm so good and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's why I should have taken a break, because my mental just wasn't good. And then, like, we started with, like, a roster with, like, TC, Buryu, Yawar, and Boba, and myself, and that didn't end up that well. We brought in Resolution and started going a lot better, and we brought in Theban, 1437, and the roster started going really well. I switched roles and everything was looking really strong. We performed really well in scrims, but then EG had, like, a blow up, and me and Bubba went back to EG, and That's why. But like at that year's TI, they actually did get second, but it was only a resolution from that roster.
Yeah,
we had actually trialed some streams with Saxa, who I just won TI or coached at TI 11 to win. But he actually tried on a team, and he was part of the squad on DC that got second that year at TI 6. But yeah, if we had continued with them, we probably wouldn't have gone second at TI, but that roster felt really strong, like in scrims and stuff in practice.
Right, obviously, I'm not from Dota anyway, but don't worry, it wouldn't stop even if I was. Like, you know my style, mate. I just ask questions how I ask them. So I'll ask this question straight up, which already probably mark it down. This will be the first question that'll hurt people's feelings, right? Explain Bulma to me, because I'm just going to tell you straight up, mate. I only watch the game. I'm not that super hooked into all the drama and all the play. So all I'll say is this. I've never thought in the game he was that sick a player, but he always seems to be around, like, not only the EG players for all the years he's been coached. Like, people say, is it like his knowledge or something? People seem to really respect this player, but I always thought he was just like an all right player. I never really got like the how he was always in the mix. So explain him to me if you can.
And Bulma was like way back in the day, like think like Dota 1 to like TI3. I think he was like a pretty top tier NA Dota player. And then he transitioned to coaching. Bulma, of all the players in Dota, I feel like he has the best like Dota memory. Like you can ask him about a certain game like that happened like 6 years ago and he'll like remember the game and sort of heroes. So he has a very like, it allows him to be very analytical about things. I don't know. The thing is, he's been working with EG for so long. Like, I don't know when he went back to start coaching them again. Maybe after TI6. But they're sort of cagey about their thoughts, right? So no one really knows exactly his impact on the team, but it seems like they're really happy with him because they stays with them for so long. And honestly, whenever someone talks about Dota, like, he's very smart about the game, which is, it's a very generic term, but I don't know how else to put it. Because the thing is, because Dota is all about winning, like, I don't know how it is in Counter-Strike or other esports, but for me, at least, I don't talk to people outside my team, like, about the game.
It's about, like, keeping the information, like, sort of, like,
yeah,
that you, like, don't want them to share what you know about the game, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there was, like, a huge uproar when tournament organizers want to, like, record comms and play little clips about them, because people are like, no, this cannot happen. Our communication is so important. You've even had teams like Team Nigma, when they need a stand-in, they took their coach's stand-in. Not because they thought it would be the best for the performance, or maybe they thought that, but I think the main reason is like they don't want to give away their comms, which is, it's sort of insane, to be honest. Like the level of secrecy that's in Dota. How is it in Counter-Strike? Like, someone needs a stand-in. I feel like they would just take someone, right? Or does it matter?
Oh, they would, absolutely. And also, yeah, the other thing is, like, first of all, you might even have a stand-in from your rival if it was, like, they weren't attending the tournament or something. Yeah, because I get the feeling, though, it's because, like, look, you're probably not going to have time to learn all the strats, and the strats, like, evolve month to month to month. What, in this sense, then, is it just a mentality? Or do teams actually each have, like, unique things you think about the game or, like, things they understand about role interactions that other people don't have? Is there, like, secret sauce in that sense, do you think?
I mean, for sure, there's secrets, but I feel like, from my perspective, like, the reason why I don't mind talking about a lot of things, like, I'll do some draft analysis on TI-11, draft and stuff, because I feel like the stuff that people are secret about are probably stuff that they all know. It's just, like, in different ways, and, like, I don't know. It feels really too cagey and secretive to me. But there is some level to it. Like, I think if you listen to they had, like, these little true site clips at TI-11, which were executed the best. But if you listen to, like, the team comms in those clips, you have, like, Secret and Liquid who are, like, screaming their brains out, and you'll have us who are, like, very calm and just, like, saying what's going on. And, like, there are differences in how teams want to communicate. And I don't even know if how we do it is correct or whatever, but it's very different than what they do. And obviously they got second and third at TI, so it's not like what I'm saying. Like, maybe the hype and, like, that stuff, it adds to their gameplay a lot, whereas for us, like, that would never work.
Sure.
So I don't know.
In that case, did you think it was weird when, like, PPD would just do those, like, complete draft breakdowns where he was giving, like, all crazy insight and, like, what he was thinking and stuff? Didn't that seem weird then as a result?
I mean, no, I think that doing that stuff is sort of good for the scene. Like, it's interesting. It makes people think.
Mega, yeah.
But honestly, I can sort of see, like, it being good for your competitors, right? Like, just getting in the head of the enemy captain, but I also feel like even if I talk about some things in Dota, like, if people want to copy us, like, they can. You can try to copy someone's thoughts, but they're still going to be ahead of you, right? Like, Dota's, like most esports, is ever evolving. If you're just copying the past, you're never going to reach number one. So
sure.
It's not that big a deal, I think.
Right, after this Digital Chaos team, as you said, you got brought back to Evil Geniuses, right? You sort of explained it earlier. Like, I guess I don't need to hit the drama. Like, as you say, everyone wants to win. It's one of the best teams. You have some of the best players. Was it really that easy? Like, put it this way. Was there ever even a conversation about getting kicked and them fucking over? Or was it just like, want to come back? Cool, right, I'm back. And then just like, let's just not address the elephant in the room.
No, that one was a really hard decision. Like, because what happened was that they had like this internal blow up, and Sphere, PPD, and Sumail, and they asked me and Bulba to come back because Bulba was coaching us at TF5, and Bulba basically said, "Oh, yo, it's up to you, man." So he put all the responsibility on me,
okay.
And I didn't really know what to do because like I really like the current team, as I mentioned, but it's very hard to say no to like a team that you had so much success with. It's very hard to say no to like just a player like Sumail, right?
Sure.
And there's actually two options. Either we would take Fear and Sumail, potentially, or me and Bob would go join them. Those are the two options that were sort of presented to us.
Because it was like a mutiny within the team. Like you said, it was like two camps of...
Yeah, I mean, I think... Well, Universe and Arteezy went to Secret, so they lost two players. And then... Or is that what happened? I don't even remember.
That
so long
certain,
ago.
That was what happened, okay. I'm pretty sure, yes.
Yeah, no, that was a really hard decision. I think... Like, if I had taken a break after TI5, it might have ended up being the right decision. But obviously, with how it went, it was the wrong decision. Or maybe it would have just been shit either way with DC. I don't know. But I ended up, like, the team ended up not being very good. So.
The funny thing is, when you say it like that, like, obviously it's hard to turn down playing with someone like Sumail, etc. Because obviously, like you say, if the mentality is to win, like, these are the absolute best players. That's the best way to win.
Yeah.
What I want to ask is this, though. Because what's funny is, I feel like in Dota, there's a really unique approach, which is... If you're the people who are the really good 4 and 5 position players, especially captains, like actually, if anything, the young stars all want to get to you. They want to get to a Poppy or a PPD or something like that, because that's where they think they can win. But if you are those other players, the downside is you might have all the knowledge, but you've got to have a couple of like mega carries. You've got to have an Arteezy, you've got to have a Sumail, or later on Resolution. You're going to have some mega player, otherwise you're just not going to win the game, right?
Yeah, I think it's weird because you probably had this debate before, but there's like nothing really in esports that stops like a 25-year-old from being just as good as like an 18, right? It's mostly what I've heard is people come to conclusions like, oh, how much work you put in. When you're 18 or 16, you're literally playing the game for 16 hours a day. But I think this past TI, it sort of changed a bit of what you said, because my team is really old, right? Like Tundra as a team, I think they're probably the oldest TI winner on average age. And I think like everyone on that team, like even though they're not as young, like they put in the most work I've seen of any team in Dota. Like, even compared to, like, the young kids and everything, like, they play so many pubs, they talk about the game, they're just living the game all the time. And I think that proved, like, you need the star players, but really, the star players, it doesn't have to be someone younger, it just has to be someone really good, right?
Right.
The age is just, like, sort of a correlation to that. Like, it just always happens that the star players are some young guys, but I don't know, like, we have, like, 33 or Soxa or Skitter, like, 9, Snaking, like, all of our players perform really well at TI, and it's not because there's some 16-year-old grinding it out. They're just some 20-something-year-old grinding it out.
Because I'm going to ask in a minute about some of the other teams you played in, where it was more people who were, like, either teammates or friends of yours and stuff. And in those teams, like, the thing I was thinking when I was going back and looking up the old things and remembering the TIs and stuff is, like, these are more, like... Like I say, it's more like social teams, it seems. It didn't feel like you were as cutthroat. Does that mean the opportunities weren't there in later years to be in the absolute best teams, or did the community have a different perception of you, do you think? Because you were with the business, the same two cores of people for the rest of your career, almost till you became a coach.
Yeah, so it's weird because TI makes the scene also work in cycles on how people think. So after TI5, people are like, oh, we just need to make the best team we can, because EG, sort of robotic team that just added some really high-skill players, TI6 was won by Wings, right? And Wings were like a group of friends who just came up, you know, someone that came from the same village, and they worked together and they like grew over the years. So now people want to do that. So, you know, we represented that in NP into C9. And then, I don't know, it just, like, whatever the last person team that won does, like, people just try to emulate and copy that, which is why, you know, like, after OG, everyone's like, oh, friendship, flowers, friendship. You know? And, like, which, it's not a bad thing, right? Like, you want to take what's good from the winners. But it's sort of crazy how much it steers towards the Dota. Like, you only copy the winners based on, you know? Like, there's a chance that the winners weren't even the best team at TI. Like, honestly, at TI5, like, Secret are probably a better team than us. We never played them, right? Yeah. They lost to Ehome and MVP. So we actually never played versus Secret. They might have been a better team than us. I don't know. They sort of didn't practice for a month before TI for whatever reason. So, yeah.
Sure. Right. Obviously, I'll rewind it then to when you rejoined EG. So when you rejoined EG, the key detail to point out as well here is you didn't just rejoin and just come back. You were playing like fucking one position. Like, here's the question I have, right? In the rest of your career, I've noticed you've just gone back to being like a four or five position. And obviously people know that's your niche, right? Did you actually think at this time, like, I can actually be like, I can be an RTZ, I can be an Atul Envy, I can just be like a true carry. Did it seem like a good idea at the time?
Yeah, it was. I think it was something that I enjoyed more, a lot more, like playing carry at that time. I also played carry on like NP following TI6 all the way up until we went to C9 after the DAC that year, where I went back to four. But I didn't perform well in carry, but I think I had some knowledge advantages on other carry players. Like, I had some good rotations and some aggressive play, but I think I lost a lot of that when I went to EG. Because what happened, like, basically, I took a team that was, it was formed basically as my own, right? Like, the game's going to be played around me and the moves I want to make. I brought to EG, where their culture was a lot more about, like, you don't talk about Dota that much outside the game. It's more like a business. It's not like they don't talk. It's not like they didn't have ideas. They had very good ideas. They ended up getting third at TI that year, right? Off their ideas. Their ideas, honestly, they could have even been better than mine. I have no idea, even with hindsight, but I needed a team that would, like, support me in doing my ideas. I went to EG. I didn't have that. Like, even me and Bulba stopped talking as much because we were, like, under so much pressure and stress that, like, couldn't really function as players. Probably, like, a weakness of myself and Bulba as players as well, just in general. So
when you say that, like, the team doesn't talk much, right? Is it just, like, you're making it sound to me a little bit almost like it's, like, I've heard there's actually, like, professional teams that are like this, where it's, like, if the pressure's enormous, everyone's getting paid a lot. There's perception sort of, like, look, everyone's supposed to just do their job. Like, we shouldn't have to, like, we're not friends. We're here to just win, right?
Yeah, I think that is sort of how it is. I mean, the players are friendly. Like, I enjoy playing on the EG rosters. Honestly, there's, like, some pretty good times, but it wasn't like, I don't know, like, you go for walks together and talk about the game and, like, really develop your strategies and go into deep about stuff. People are just like, if you had some ideas, obviously you bring it to the team, and you could work on them. It's not like there's some, like, huge barrier, but it's very different than the environment I had in, like, C9 or, like, some of my future teams or whatever.
The reason I also asked about going back to the one position and playing that role is also, to me, part of what actually, I did think it was a bit messed up they kicked you from EG, because as you were pointing out, you had, like, a totally different hero pool than everyone else, because to play the position you were playing with some of those heroes, it was like, no one was doing that in the game at the time. Like, that was kind of your edge, right?
Yeah. I mean, the hero pool thing is, it's weird because in Dota, like, you think, like, people can just learn heroes. But I think especially at this last TI, like, people have learned, like, you need to spam these heroes. Like, it takes a long time to learn these heroes. I don't know. One example is, like, I think we're the only team in the tournament that played Doom really well. Like, there's this hero, he's, like, 46% win rate in pubs. Outside of us, he was 4-9 at TI. And we won every single game with this hero. We didn't lose a single game with Doom, I think. And then there was, like, some 5-day break at TI, and none of the other top 4 teams really learned him. And I'm sort of still confused about that, but I'm also, like, thinking that it's not that easy to just learn these heroes and integrate them into your team, even within, like, a full week at TI. So, hero pool stuff, like, I think people have realized it's more unique to players than just, like, oh, we'll just make this new player who's overall higher skilled from their perspective just learn this new hero and play it.
Yes. This is something as an outsider I often noticed as well. As much as everyone always brags about, like, oh, all the heroes are picked and you can play them. Look, these ones flex to all the roles. It's like, as you say, yeah, in theory, that might be a strong hero you could pick and you could tell someone on your team, play it. But sometimes it makes more sense, even if you're in a different position. Why don't you play it if you're the best on it? If you're the guy who spammed it a million times, you know, all the intricate. Because I think there's some amazing players at the 4-5 positions who have, like, the one hero that's like, why is that picked there? But just that one guy knows how to use it in, like, a sick way in a team fight or something, you know?
Yeah, I think that happens a lot in Dota. Like, there's a player called ATF, and he plays a lot of Timbersaw. He's, like, the biggest Timbersaw spammer. And people pick a hero like Monkey King to counter him, who's supposed to be a counter on paper. But ATF has played this matchup, like, 1,000 times. Okay. And you have played this matchup, like, 10 times.
Yes.
So even though he's supposed to get countered, he ends up winning the lane anyways. And when you can break the draft like that, like, your hero can break the counters, it just gives you some insane draft advantage. Because now, like, we can't counter with our best counter. Like, what are we supposed to do? We have no idea what to do against this hero. And then he's played the matchup he's good against 1,000 times as well. So it's not like you can just give him this hero and all of a sudden you end up with oh, we have to ban this hero, or we have to plan our entire draft around this hero, you become really like tunnel visioned and easy to predict.
Right. In Evil Geniuses, the thing that I actually thought was a bit weird as well is it actually started totally fine. Like the first few events were looking decent, but then obviously that major went badly. And then it was just like, that was the end of the project. Like, what I wanted to ask is this. What is the logic in a scenario like that of like when you pull the plug? Because the other problem with everything being about TI is, as everyone knows from that first OG win, where like on paper, there's no way they should have won because of how they put the team together like 1 second before the qualifier because those players left them. Like you also need to sort of figure out like if this isn't the team, we have to pull the plug now because we've only got a few months to get the next one together and still get the TI, right? So was it a shock when this not only didn't go well, but like the whole project was just over?
I think at that point, no, because even though the first two tournaments, they didn't go that badly, I think the level of play that we expected wasn't at the same level, and we just...
Sometimes you really think you were just going to come out and start winning?
Yeah. I mean, maybe we shouldn't have, but yeah.
Right? Yeah, fair enough.
Like, that's what we wanted, at least, right? Like, when, I don't know, like, you have, like, some Sumail, like, oh, Sumail 1x9, you know, you're just going to win. But, like, sometimes it's just not clicking in-game in terms of communication, and, you know, it... Like, I think it changed. Like, the second time we were kicked from EG was definitely deserved. Like, we should get kicked that. Just not sinking at all in the team, and the comms weren't good or anything.
By the way, just as an aside, even though it's not related to you and play at this time, as you say, it wasn't just Arteezy who went out to Secret. Obviously, the big drama at the time was like, oh my God, Universe betrayed everyone. He was supposed to, because everyone at the time in the community just fucking loved Universe. He was considered the best guy ever. Yeah.
Before TI5, that was Zai, I think.
No, I'm on about when they made the one where you came into Evil Geniuses again. Arteezy and Universe went out. So the question is,
The question
I have is this. What do you actually think? Like, does this imply anything about Universe's career or where he was at in it? Because before he left Evil Geniuses, dude, his stock was super high. People thought he was like the god off later. Like, everyone had even what, but I've noticed the rest of his career. It seemed like it became a bit meh after that. Like, he had a few different times where he tried to be in good teams, but like, he never had the same status. What would you explain that as? What do you think happened to him?
I mean, after he left to Secret, they had like a bad team. That was a super team that failed. But when he came back to EG, they got third at TI that year. Universe is like, he's actually one of the most hardworking players I know, and he's a really good teammate. I don't really know what makes people not successful in Dota. Like, I think he had the skill to do it, and maybe like sometimes you like choose. Sometimes you choose the wrong teammates too, right?
Sure.
Like, I mean, I coached him on a couple of teams, so maybe it's my fault. But like, I coached him on Forward, I coached him on Fnatic. But, like, I don't really have an idea what would make someone not succeed. Like his work ethic was good. His hero pool was good. We disagreed on some things about the game, of course. Like, I think you should. Like, I think if you're all on the same ideas, then what's the point of a coach? But I can't really tell you an answer for that.
Fair enough. So after this, as you say, you didn't technically go to TI as a player that year, but you went to coach Secret, right? First of all, why did that happen? And then secondly, wasn't that a bit weird? Because I was asking some of the people who've been almost like, fuck with your life, just going in and out of EG.
Yeah, it's super weird. I don't know. That year was... That was a unique year, you know? You just had some... Have you seen, like, the cloud meme with Arteezy moving from EG to Secret
yes.
and back? Yeah, that was pretty much the year. There's just, like, a all rotating over.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing is, like, everything's really cagey in Dota, but everyone's also really friendly at LANs, you know? Because you just have... I think it's like this in every esport, but, like, even, like, the toxic people online, they're, like, super friendly and nice in person because, like, you're just meeting these people who put in, like, thousands and thousands of hours into the same passion as you, right? Because even with all the money involved, like, first and foremost, like, you start playing Dota because you love this game. And this passion, like, it drives conversations and, like, a sense of, like, camaraderie between editors at the events. So what happened is, after we got kicked from EG, Secret approached Bulba about him playing for offlane, and then they also approached me about becoming the second coach. That was a really weird experience, because I had never coached before. I had no idea what coaching entailed. Honestly, coaches weren't that big in Dota at that time. We had Bulba at TI5, but it's nothing similar to what coaching is now. And I was like the second coach. I was supposed to focus on like the micro side, and Theban 1437 at the time was supposed to focus on the macro side. But the team was just like, that team was a disaster. Like, they were dead on arrival, and we managed to like pull it together to qualify for TI that year. But even then, like, that was a rough one.
right? There's a few things that I think in competition are just human nature, whether people admit it in interviews or not. So two of them are these. One, if you get kicked from a team or something like that, part of you, no matter how much, even if they're your friends, part of you wants to see them lose, because that would imply like maybe they shouldn't have kicked me. And then the other thing is, if a team succeeds without you, again, even if you know like maybe it would be different if I was there, part of you is like, fuck, I should be there. So this TI, it's got to be a bit brutal that like the new DC lineup comes second and then Evil Jesus come third. Like part of that's like, what the fuck? What about me?
Yeah. No, that's rough to watch for sure. No, I think the two things you said are definitely true. Like even if you're like actively trying not to think that, sometimes you'll have these insidious thoughts like, ooh, I hope they lose. It's going to feel good. Honestly, it's... speaking of those two thoughts, you know, at like TI5, I think the happiest moment for people on that team was not winning TI. It was when we were in the practice room watching Secret lose.
Of course.
Like, I've never heard my team get so loud. I think they were screaming louder than after we won TI. It was insane. So, you know.
Sure. So after this, you then went, and as you say, you were playing the one position again, but you were on Team NP, which is where you reunited with your boy Eternal Envy, right? So give me this, right? Give me the, how did this team come around? Was it like, because I've noticed the weird thing about Eternal Envy is, even though he himself, on the internet, it's like you said before, he seems like he's involved in all the drama, he's always beefing with someone. He's another guy where if he went to LAN, he's just friends with everyone, right? So were you always just friends with him? Was it always like, did you think you were always going to play together again at some point after all the success on Cloud9? It was inevitable, right?
Well, I really like Envy, and I think, honestly, like Envy has taught me more about Dota than any other player in the scene overall. So I think, like, I respect him a lot, and the Team NP, it was like basically four idiot coaches, like me, SVG, 1437, and Envy. So, or Envy was a coach, but it's three idiot coaches, Envy and MSS. And MSS was, like, our sort of newer high-skill player. And SVG had just coached EG, me and 1437 had just coached Secret, and Envy was a player in Secret. And we wanted to play together and sort of grow together as a team. Our plan was to grow together for the full year. It didn't end up happening because we just wanted to make a roster change or whatever. But that was a plan after Wings. We want to copy those last year winners, grow together into something greater.
How would you explain Eternal Envy to someone who's more casual in Dota? Because famously, right, obviously Arteezy Storm is like best player never to win TI, I think, because it's Arteezy. But I always think the problem is there's a lot of people in Dota for real, dude. Think Eternal Envy because of some of the personality elements. It's just a meme, but I'm always like, look, I know he definitely had some mad throws and there was times when he maybe was in a slump and because of his personality, it's going to be easy to hate on him. But like sometimes he could be a fucking amazing player too. Like he has won some unwinnable games I've seen, mate, like some epic ones.
For sure. No, Envy is like, he's like a meme, but both ways, you know? Like either he like does some like insane shit for the good or for the bad, and it's 50-50, you don't really know. I do not think I can describe Eternal Envy to people in terms of Dota. It's just, he's just such a unique player, and his ideas are, and I think for the majority of Dota, he's been so far ahead of people in how he thinks about the game, that it also translates into stuff going crazy either way, right? Because he'll see like something out of nothing to create a win condition, and he'll execute that, and then you'll have these insane games like some Rapier Ember slide fisting everyone at Shanghai Major. But then you'll also see like his idea was too far ahead of his teams, or it's just flat out wrong. I don't know, either or. And he'll just throw some unlosable game because he thinks his team should be doing something, but they're not. And, you know, there's some communication breakdown. But I guess he's just like a, chaotic random.
How would you describe, like you say there, because that's one thing I want to kind of touch on and bring out some of the essence of him, is like when you say he has like his mind for Dota, is it like, does he have like a really good like macro understanding? Because obviously, like you say, there's always some like way back into a game you've got to Levy. Is it just that he'll just find like a crazy angle to go on in a fight or something? Like what is it he's doing? Because that's the other thing I've noticed about his teams. I get the vibe as an outsider when I look at the ups and downs of his squads. Like it does seem like if you play with the Levy, you have to just sort of let him do his shit, right? You can't really have like some captain like telling him like, no, play, like you can't put him in a box, right? You have to just let him do whatever the fuck he's going to do.
Yeah, I think Envy, for sure, there's like he's really unique in how he identifies the win condition for the game. And when he identifies something, he'll double down on it. He'll play solely for that. That's the only option we have to win the game. So it leads to some insane like split push games because he thinks like, oh, this is what we need to get to. Once we get to this, then we go take a fight. And it seems like, holy shit, we need to make this happen. And then the other thing that he's really good at is he's really good at playing the map. So like how you use vision and creep waves, like his understanding of that is at an extremely high level. And maybe like I think his weakness is sort of like he thinks about these other things too much and he's not focused enough on his own role in play. Like he's the only position one that's sort of like that, and it's maybe like Ramses from the old VP2, who are they're sort of like that. And they're both sort of throwers in that sense too, because they're focused on so much, making so much happen on the map that they're not thinking about what they're supposed to do, their own hero. Like Envy will tell you, oh, go set up a gank here, go push out this wave, do this, do this. And then, you know, maybe he'll die to a gank because he's thinking of that instead of, oh, how can I make sure I don't die and hit my timing?
Like I referenced, he's obviously also sadly infamous for not having that good results at TI. As someone who's like, I've talked to him briefly at times, like all I would say is this, is like, I think I even did it, one of these reflections with him. All I would say is this, is like, I actually got the vibe again as an outsider. Like, I think he puts insane pressure on himself to actually do well at that tournament. Like, if people don't know that, he definitely isn't joking about that. He is a guy who at certain points of time really wanted to win TI, was putting in fucking mad hours trying to find every edge in the game and get the right to, in fact, that's part of why he was doing all the fucking musical chairs, bringing the different teammates, right? And trying to get RTs into him constantly. Like, he really did want to win.
Yeah. And I think that's something that's evolved more as Dota has gone on. Because especially, as I mentioned before, like the OG things, like you saw like Ana, he's like, I can't play, blah, blah, and like Nota and Seb are bringing her up. Like that's something that teams have started to add a lot more. I think OG had like a really good, dead, like Mia, you know, from Astralis and Counter-Strike.
Ah, right, yes.
The psychologist. I think she worked, I think it's Mia, I don't remember if I got
it. Yeah, the Finnish lady, right? I believe she did work with OG.
So yes. She worked with OG at TI 8 and 9. And then for us at TI 11, we had Dan, who's like a sports psychologist from the UK. And it like that mental / sports psychology side has become a lot bigger in Dota. I think like this pressure that you're talking about that Eternal Envy puts on himself, it's something that like for us at least, the sports psychologist helped us see as like this pressure is like it's gonna happen. But it's like how you like deal with the pressure or like how you use it as a positive force rather than trying to prevent it from happening or think, oh, I shouldn't feel this way, blah blah blah. You just have to learn good coping mechanisms or how to channel it well. Right. So that part of Dota is increasing a lot. Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all good. In the team NP, this is another team that started out really well. Like, it looked like, oh, this is going somewhere as a squad. Like I remember, for example, one of the teams he kept beating a whole bunch of times was that eHome team. It was actually a very good team, if people don't know. This is no joke. This is one of the good lineups with all the classic Chinese players on. Like, the way the team began, obviously, this is another story where, like, you had all these, like, results where it's getting closer and closer, and then, unfortunately, TI just bombs at the end, doesn't it? Right? That's not unique. Obviously, people know TI is some of the craziest up and down results of anything. But like, what? How would you explain the NP story that year? Because it looked like I said that you looked like you were heading somewhere good. Like that should have been a deep run at TI.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a pretty long journey, I guess. But after TI, we formed. We said we wanted to work together to improve. I think we had a lot of cool innovations about the game. Like people. So there's like a lane mechanic that people do now where they pull the melee creeps onto the range creep because the range creeps are less tanky than melee creeps and they're worth more gold and EXP. So you get this like range creep deny basically really early on the lane for free. That was actually an innovation that Envy brought up. I don't know if he saw it somewhere, he discovered it himself, but we started doing that really early on. We started improving. We went to some tournament in Montreal. I forget the name. Only land in Canada under the TI, okay. But... I think we got second to Wings there, and we beat eHome and EG there. It was like best of ones or something, but we were like, oh, we're looking really good. Everything's feeling really good. And then we're playing. Stuff was feeling okay. We weren't that happy with our level of play, but we're ever improving. We're happy with it. And we went to the Boston Major. And we played versus VP, and they had like some no one Ramses. Like they were really good for the next couple of years. And people don't know this, but there was actually a bug where the Observer had insane bots turned on one side, so that side would get an additional 25% gold in EXP.
Okay.
Just for our lobby. It was like a mistake. Okay. So we lost to them when we had that EXP gold advantage.
Holy moly, okay.
And they beat us with that one. And it didn't matter because we lost with both sides, right? Like, so they didn't change anything.
Right.
We talked to Evolve about it, and they're like, yeah, you know, and like we're okay with not getting changed because, you know, it's sort of embarrassing. But it is what it is. And like, I don't know, we just could not compete with them at all. Like, they were just so much better than us. And I think that sort of, that for the original roster, that's sort of the beginning of the end. We lost a lot of faith in, like, oh, we're improving, but, like, are we improving fast enough? Do we actually have the players to do this? Are we learning fast enough? And it ended up accumulating in the DAC that year. Like, we went there. We ended up not doing that well. We lost that DAC, and we decided to do a roster switch. We swapped out our two supports for Pi and Fada, who came back. And we moved back to one, Fada to two, me to four. We added those two players. And that team, like, it felt really good at the start as well. We went to some, I think, Malaysia tournament. Maybe ESL, I can't remember.
And
Manila Masters, yeah. We got second to EG there. And we honestly should have won that tournament. Like, we sort of choked, as that C9 roster normally does. We choked in the finals, and we got second. And I don't know, like, we were really good during the qualifiers, sort of. But actually, our boot camp, we were really good for the qualifiers. It felt good. We had this, like, team us in Toronto. Everything was good. Our manager, Helen, would, like, cook a lot of yummy food for us. We all gained a lot of weight. And then, I don't know, our boot camp before TI was, it was just a disaster. Like, we lost, like, 30 scrims in a row or something. Nothing was clicking. Everyone was super frustrated. And it wasn't, like, that team, it didn't feel toxic or anything. That's why we didn't know. Like, we'd all meme around, we'd talk, we'd have conversations. But we just sucked. And that's, like, the worst feeling, because nothing external makes us feel like we're sucking. But we just suck. So maybe it's just us, we didn't know. Eventually at TI, you know, we had a rough group stage. After one of the days, we had, like, a team talk where we just, like, we had to get it out. And this is one of the moments that, like, I take a lot of experience from. Like, we just sat there and flamed each other. And if, like, I feel like people think flaming each other is really toxic, but if you go into a conversation, like an honest conversation, guys, the reason I'm saying this is because I want to help you improve. It's not because I think you're bad. It's because I think you can improve. I want to tell you. And that helped us a lot. We actually got our shit together at the end of that TI. We started, like, copying some of what Liquid do or learning from them. Fada brought up they would build these, like, early fighting items like Wand and Raindrop every game and fight in the early game. We would do that, but we just weren't able to get it together enough for the TI. We ended up losing a very free game to Empire, where Resolution came and stood in and owned us. But yeah, that game was super free. We, like, killed four of them. We were at their tier 3 bottom. We just didn't push. Yeah, I don't know. That team was weird. We just, it wasn't toxic, but it was like toxic in a way that, apparently, what I learned from there in hindsight, is it's toxic in a way that we didn't talk about our problems enough. We weren't direct with them enough. We just tried to hold it in and not be mean to each other or whatever. Yeah, that was NP into C9, I guess.
Right. One of the things about this team as well was, like, as you say, when you made the switches and you went back to position 4 and you brought in Pylai, and Fat, etc., right? When you made this particular lineup, like, so if you go back and look at some of the results, like, I can get why if you lost that hard to VP, you'd be like, fuck, if we lose at that with a bog as well, like, are we ever going to win TI? But if you look now at some of the teams you were playing against, like, you guys were right there, though. Like, when I go and look, like, you were, like, going close with the OG that had won the back-to-back majors. Everyone was, like, thinking we're fucking super sick. Like you say, there was the, obviously EG was still good, but there was the newbie team that actually came second at that TI. Like, maybe it's hard, obviously, at the time you couldn't know what would happen later, but, like, it feels like the actual squad, considered on paper, like, this is not an all-star team that you're playing this team NP, like you say, it's a bunch of players who just want to play together. You clearly had something as a team. What do you think the strength of the team was?
I think starting the team, like, before we made the roster switch to Fada and Pi, the strength of the team was, like, we were really coordinated how much we talked and learned about the game. But we actually talked a bit too much and didn't play enough.
Okay.
To be honest on that
too
team.
Much theory.
Yeah, a bit too much theory. Yeah, once we added Pi and Fada, I think they were really high skilled and they really brought our level of gameplay up to make up for our weaknesses, and we still had some good ideas we developed. But I don't know, that's just the way Dota goes. Like, for example, like the Yellow Submarine team that became Team Spirit, that won TI10, I feel like some teams were, like, scrimming them for a long time and they just ended up emerging into the best team for that year. But, like, you can't say, like, oh, just because we were taking scrims off them, like, 6 months ago or whatever, that we would have also been at that level. Like, they were clearly working on things or discovering things and growing as a team. And you can't have the expectation that your growth was supposed to match them. So, I think it's hard to say, like, oh, we were playing on the same level as these teams and they ended up being the best. We also would have ended up being the best if we had continued on that path. And maybe would have, but you just don't really know.
Sure.
I think it's more of, like, a correlation and causation thing there.
In this era of this team, where would you say Pylai Dai was at in his career? Because I know he's someone who was held in very high regard, like, years prior, and especially at the 5 position, obviously.
On the C9 at TI7?
The NP one, yeah.
NP and C9. But he was really good. He had really strong ideas. I think the problem was that, like, we went from a team that theorycrafted too much into a team that was a lot higher skill, but we didn't merge ideas well enough because we came in, and I feel like this happened to Pi when he went to Secret 2. Like, Pi's a very vocal, emotional player. But he has a really good intuitive understanding of the game. And I think what happened on Secret and the C9 team was that he knew that stuff was going wrong. But because he was sort of scared, like, you know, I had like some TI win, Envy was like major winner. Oh, he won with Pi. And then when he went to Secret, he was like, oh, Arteezy's just going to carry me. Like, he didn't say the stuff that he thought was wrong.
Right.
And he like held it in way too much. And like, his ideas were like part of what made like the C9 team back then and the Secret team back then really, really good. He didn't say any of it. And it just wasn't, it ended up not being, he didn't get to play to his potential or anything. After that, I'm not sure. Like, he played some, like, I coached him in Fnatic. I think he played pretty well there. But ever since then, like, he hasn't found that much success, even though I think he's still a good player.
What about, obviously, we're talking about in this era generally of his career. What about, obviously, Fata was the player that came in at the time. He's another player that's had times when he's been on teams that won the championship, and he's always looking like individuals up there. But he's another person where, if you look at his total career, like, he hasn't had the TIs, like, he's had a lot of misses as well. How do you describe, how do you explain this guy to me?
Fata is, he's very smart about the game, and he's really good at reading, like, finding really small random plays and smoke pass and aggressive kills on the map, and he's very vocal about it. And I think that's his strength. I think, especially back then, he was very active as mid, and it led to our team, like, having a lot of space off his back. Like, for sure on the C9 roster and the one going to TI, like, we built our team sort of around Envy, but Fado was on who enabled it the most, in my opinion. So, no, he's a really strong player.
Right. Even though I get that, like, as we just said, if you look at the results, like, they're like, all right, into good, into, like, in this, like, skilled lineup, it's, like, getting looking pretty good. And I get that TI was bad, but, like, did the whole squad just have to disband after that? Couldn't, like, brought a couple of other players in? Like, why'd you have to disband the whole team?
It is what it is after TI, you know? I think, for example, like, after TI 11, I think every single team had a roster change. Like, almost, right? Like, maybe, like, us and Hodokiri or whatever. I don't know if I should say that or not, because I don't know what's announced. But I'm pretty sure, I don't even know for Hodokiri. It might be every single team boss who's going to have a roster after the TI. And I was like, holy shit, that's so many roster changes. And I looked at the past TIs, and honestly, it's almost the same. You know? Like, there's so many roster changes, because, again, like, you just, I don't know. You see, like, oh, I think this roster will bear synergy. I don't know if it's good or not. Like, I think that you do need some level of growth and stuff, but it's just how it is in the Dota scene. So, and Fada, like, he had a lot of highs, I think, with Liquid, and I think that's just how Dota is. It's so volatile. That's why I respect Puppy so much, because Puppy is, like, the only player who's been to every TI and been at the top so frequently and so consistently. But even Puppy, right? Like, I was with him at TI6, we got last place. Even this, like, he got second at this TI, but their year was really bad. Like, they lost every DPC, they didn't get to go to any majors, because, I mean, maybe EU is just too hard a region, but they didn't have good DPCs. And, I mean, they ended up doing well in Malaysia, but that was it. It's just Malaysia and TI.
It's like I say, though, I get why people changed the team. But, like, that's another thing I want to ask about. It also feels like another part of what happens is, if people don't do well at TI, they don't just want to change. Like, you could obviously change, like, a carry position and totally change the lineup of the team or change the captain or something. It feels like people just want a total clean break, though. Sometimes they want to go and, like, if we all leave, if I go to a totally different team, that'll be different. It's like, if people want it to be radically different, it feels like. As I say, like, it'd be one thing if you just did, like, one or two moves, you know, that could still change a lot about a squad.
Well, it's also like, you know, if you have good performance in TI, like another team, you start talking to people and they're like, oh, come play with us. We'll be really good. We have a sponsor, blah, right. Blah, blah. So it's like, it's both ways. But also, I think a lot of teams are started with like some team bond or identity at the start. For example, like the team NP one, like we all want to grow together. And right. We actually broke our own identity when we made a roster change, right? Like, I think overall, that was probably not a great thing to do, to like change rosters. We all like promise, like, oh, we're going to grow together and work this year into TI. And, like, once your identity is broken as a team, like, you don't have much to stay together for. And also, like, Dota is so competitive and so focused on winning that when you lose, like, what? Like, are you going to blame yourself all the time? Like, you know, you're going to... Okay, you might blame yourself a bit, but I think it wears on you a lot more, right? Or you might see, like, one teammate's not working as hard as you think he should be. Or maybe you're not even seeing how hard he's working. You're just, you know, you don't have full vision, but you think these things like, oh, the reason we're not succeeding is we're not working hard enough on this. I don't think this person will change to that. So we need to make a change. It's not like unreasonable thoughts, but there's also like, I feel like teams change rosters way too much. Like, you lose so much growth and knowledge that you built together, and you have to restart all over when you bring these new players. So it's just hard. And I think we've seen in history, like, most roster changes don't really work, but sometimes they do. So it is what it is.
I'll phrase this question very carefully. Obviously, from a legal sense, with the way contracts are prepared, no one would ever poach or, you know, interfere with someone else's contract status. But let's just say colloquially, if we said, like, make a team. I've heard that if you look at TI, either in the crowd, once, like, they've already started to get down to the last four teams or so, and especially the after party, I've heard it's just people just talking about what team they're going to make, mate. And it's like, you can just see, like, people on the table, like, oh, shit, they're making a team. Like, wait a minute, he's not with his team. Like, I've heard it's just like that. It's ridiculous. You can already see, like, all the cogs moving, as it were.
Yeah, no, it's a ridiculous fiend party. That's the after party. Everyone but the winners, usually. I mean, I got kicked after winning, so I'm an exception. But, like, they're, like, talking to each other and making plans. Even before... Some teams are even talking before TI start, which is super toxic, in my opinion, you know?
Sure.
But, like, they don't believe in their teams already, like, planning these things. No, it's just how it is. And I don't know, like, contracts in Dota are really weird, because I think... I don't know any teams except maybe the Eastern European ones where the org controls the roster. Like, I know for Team Spirit, I think the org put together the roster, and obviously they had a lot of success with that. They won TI10 and stuff, but, like, it's all player-controlled. Like, when a roster change needs to happen, it's not because the org is like, yeah, we want to do this. It's the players will get together, they'll all decide together, and then they'll bring it to the org. And because of that, like, I see, like, in League or Counter-Strike, they'll be like, oh, you're getting fined for talking to players who are under contract, like, especially in League with Riot, right?
Yes.
They like to fine everyone. But I've never even heard of that happening in Dota. I think there was some drama where, like, I think Alliance was mad at someone for talking to their players. But I haven't seen that in Dota at all. And, like, I don't really understand. Like, all the players know each other. They all have each other on Steam. They just message each other. Like, oh, what do you think of this? And they're like, okay, I guess that's talking to each other. So I don't really know. I feel like it happens in other esports too, no? Like, don't the players talk before they make these roster changes? It's just...
Put it this way. Here's the thing. Since it's a Dota, who gives a fuck anyway?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, even in League of Legends, where you get fined like that, you just have to be more creative with how you talk to the player. Like, you got to make sure, like, no one's listening, or you got to, like, use fucking cord, or, oh, I'd be interested if we were on holiday next year. There's ways around it, isn't there? You can get... And the joke is, because it's actually, like, technically, like, both... I mean, it'd be legal anyway if you went to court, which no one's getting taken to court, but Riot themselves, obviously, can just punish you directly. You say they run the game. All I'll say is, like, people just sort of know their way around it. And in fact, the fact that it's a bit trickier just makes it, like, if you're good at that, it's a way bigger competitive advantage, you know? Like,
yeah.
There's some legendary players where the joke is, like, one of them, this guy Perks from Europe, the joke is, like you were talking about there with the after party, it's like there was a famous joke that, like, he just goes in, like, the hot tub with all the players he's going to sign at the hotel or something, you know? Like, that's, like, the getaway area where magically you end up on his team next year. So it definitely is a thing in other esports. Just, I feel like in Dota, like you're saying, it's a player run game and everything's about TI. It's like, you may as well just openly do it. Like, once you're out the tournament, who gives a fuck, right?
Yeah, it's really open in Dota. Like, people sort of know what's happening. And I mean, I think it's sort of needed in esports, because I feel like in normal sports, like, maybe there's a little bit less synergy. Like, how you behave in a locker room is like, it's like something that people are taught over the years, and they have, like, reputations based on it. Like, I've heard stuff about, like, hockey players where, oh, they're really good locker room leaders. This is why we want them in the roster. I think in Dota, it's like, the amount of time you spend together in Dota, I think even compared to other esports, is insane. Like, you are with these people literally for months at a time. Like, our last DBC, we had boot camp for 7 weeks. It was awful. Please don't do it again.
Seven weeks
into tournaments sometimes. Like, we played a couple tournaments after boot camping for 7 weeks. But you spend way too long with each other, and you need to know how your personalities match up and sync up. And you can't do that if it's just the orgs negotiating some contracts, right? Like, oh, this player looks really good. Also, people in Dota are really bad, so why would you want someone who doesn't know anything about the game deciding your roster for you, you know? Like, oh, he looks good, and they'll just get you some player who's active on Twitter or something, you know? You don't want that.
Sure. Right, after this, you made the team, which, like, started again as one of those, like, oh, it's just friends, but that became, like, the real team. Obviously, eventually, Digital Chaos again, which was when you had Ritsu and Bryle and Moon Meander and Kitra. Right, when you made this squad, Right, this looks, if I'm being real, like, look, Moon Meander, etc., everyone knows him, etc., but this looks like it's a step down. What happened? Did you just get left out of the musical chairs? What happened?
So, okay, so I know there's a lot of talk at after parties about forming teams and stuff, but I've actually never done this.
Rosie, so you should have.
Like, you mentioned perks in League of Legends. I'm like the anti-perks. Like, I don't talk to people who aren't on my team, and I don't really talk to people like that at after parties and Fiend and stuff. So, and also, I think my stock went way down, right? Like, after TI5, my stock was really high, but eventually, after you lose enough, people stop respecting you as much and, like, wanting to play on a team with you. And also, like, I wanted to, sometimes for me, it's like, I want to play with people that I enjoy playing the game with and enjoy sharing ideas with. And that's probably why I only played with, like, a certain group of people for so long. We started that team after, like, we picked up Brow, me and Moon, we formed a team, like, Animal Planet or something. I can't even remember the name.
Yeah, that was the name.
We got scammed by some Canadian company, Iceberg.
Yeah.
That was full-on scam. Yo, they tricked us. They paid their CSGO team and Smash players, like, salaries. And we checked with them. Like, okay, they're playing salaries. It seems good. We had, like, a lawyer look over the contracts. No, that they just paid them to trick us. Now we would join.
Right.
And they're, like, looking to, oh, they're going to join. Now we can use them to get sponsored. The classic esports. Yeah, and then we, oh, I guess at the start of that team, it was with, like, Envy, Snay, me, Moon, and Bryo, right? That was that first animal. Okay. Or Pandas. Oh, no, I can't remember.
Pandas was later. That was like a... That
Pandas
was
later?
Yes. That was a later on team, yes.
Oh, I don't know.
We just had some of the same players. It's all good. Here's the thing I was going to say, though. Like, obviously, this particular team did fuck all. Like, you basically went to, like, Indonesia Minor, because it started and they just bombed it, and then that was just it, right?
Yeah.
Like, the joke is, you joined DC officially on, like, March 11th, and then, like, a month later, you just kicked anyway. Like, it's all
rough.
Done.
Yeah, I felt bad for DC, because they were, like, ready to support us and stuff. No, that was really bad by us. I think internally, we're just... We're so, I don't know, you can burn out really fast in Dota, because I think even more than other esports, the time requirements that you put in are just higher. Again, it's all about winning. I think maybe like League is the thing that replicates, like how people view the Korean scene in League is the Western scene in Dota. Like you grind the game, like it's your entire life. Right. I think the reason why I stopped playing a lot, I went into like some coaching and casting, is because I felt like I played this game for like 8 years and I was probably like the same human. Like I didn't learn anything. Do anything for myself. I just played Dota. I didn't take vacations. You just play Dota, think about the game, talk about the game, Dota, Dota, Dota. And I didn't really want that for myself. So, yeah.
I know what you mean, because I made it one of Thorin's like esports laws, just to be witty on Twitter. But it's a real point I'm genuinely making, which is I always say, if you see a pro gamer, just get his age and take 5 off the number. And that's how he is like, maturity and emotional wise. Because what I always tell people is, dude, these guys unironically are just sat on a PC like 10, 12 hours a day just playing. Like they haven't got time to actually like experience life that much and have like a full like a proper relationship, not just have a girlfriend, you know, like try and build a life. Like you kind of do, you get stuck in like you're in stasis almost in your life. It's just the game you're trying to develop in, right? It's pretty intense, but I don't think fans know, right?
Yeah, no, it's crazy. I mean, for me, like my personal life, I got sort of lucky. Like because I was in university before I went into Dota. I played StarCraft, but like I had met my girlfriend like in 2013 something 2012 2013.
Around
she
that
won't
time.
Watch this. It's fine. It's fine. It's 2013. And so I had like a relatively normal life outside of Dota, which is probably why I wasn't like in the Fiend circles as much. Like I still talked to the people I was friendly with, but like I wanted to maintain like an outside life outside of Dota, which I'm really happy that I did. But for a lot of people, like you play Dota with and against people, and then they're also your friends that you're playing with, so you'll play custom games with them on your downtime, or you talk to them, and it's a very small social group, and you're right, like, you never learn about anything, and it's also what you said, like this, you know how people say, like, people have stream personas? Like, especially for esports game or not? I think that's just dumb. Like, I think you're right with that, so, yeah.
Indeed. So obviously, this was the time period, though, where because that lineup just went bust, basically, you did your first, like, real stint at coaching. Because as you say, the secret one was, like, that was when you just add a sixth person to be the coach, and it like, fuck, this guy's here. It's like, but no one knows if they're doing anything, and especially the teams with the big captains in. The assumption back in the day was the coach is doing fuck all, isn't it? Like, Puppy or fucking whoever, Kuroki's leading the team, innit? In this era, though, this was like when coaching was starting to get real, so you came in and coached Eternal Envy and Universe and Pylite, like, all these former teammates, like, people you round, right? This team was pretty fucking good, mate. Like, this is one where, like, I know it did bad at the TI, but, like, the results before that were really legit. The Birmingham result and the Daughter Summit and stuff. Like, what was it actually like? Like, was it more, was this more real coaching? Like, I'm actually the coach of this team.
So, okay. So after the TI 16, like, the team was sort of dead on arrival, but I was also like, I said, like, I agreed with the cook kick the second EG, but as you said, like, it still, like, damages you. And, like, I wasn't going into coaching, like, fully prepared. I sort of, like, went from one thing to another. Like, I went from TI 5 EG, getting kicked, into this team, into, back to EG, into coaching. Like, it was like, bam, 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 no breaks. So that one, I wasn't a real coach. This was my first one, as you mentioned, that I was, like, a full official coach. Sorry. So I went into that one a lot more prepared. Like, I'd actually make, like, some more detailed notes on games. And I was, like, I was there long enough that we were trying to, like, form my own identity and stuff. We could work on problems. And I think overall, like, I learned a lot about coaching from that team. I think the thing is about Dota is, like, it's a lot of accumulated knowledge. So you just take all the failures in the past and you group them up and you, like, take what you know to form something better. But that team, like, again, like, I got to learn a lot from Envy, and I also learned, like, oh, I need to talk, force conversations with people a lot more. Because a lot of the problems that we had actually in the NPC 9 days, like, they're sort of similar to Fnatic. Like, people understood that something was going wrong with the team. Even though we were having good performances, like, you understand, like, your level play is not where you want it. You want to be at number one. You're not happy in Dota. Like, you're not happy with number two or number three or number four or whatever. You need number one. You need to win these tournaments. You need to feel, at least, like you can win any tournament. And we didn't talk about some of the problems. So that was the coaching of that team, I guess.
Right. One thing I wanted to ask about is there's a famous trope that people always say in interviews, which is in teams where you have like a sixth player or rotation and like the rare occasions that happens, people always say you actually feel more nervous when you're the one not in the game and you watch your teammates and you're like, fuck,
yeah.
Like, I can't control it. I've just like, I'm like a prisoner, like fucking clockwork orange. Like, holy shit. Right. I was just thinking of that factor, right? When you coached this team, because mate, if it's stressful to be Eternal Envy's teammate sometimes in the server, holy fuck, coaching him must be mental. He was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's awful because there's something that Theban said to me, 1437. He's like, the worst thing that can happen for a coach or drafter is when your team goes and fights at level one and some random room fight. Because it completely changes right. How the game's supposed to go. And it's as you said, like you have no control. I hate watching games. I hate watching my team. Even when we're doing well at TI, I still sort of hated watching games. Because like you just don't know what's happening. One thing that they've started doing for TIs is that the coaches can actually listen to the in-game comms. Like, right. You have the headsets.
That's cool.
So that makes it a lot better because you can, like, judge the mood of the team and you can adjust to that. You have, like, more stuff to talk about. But, like, yeah, coaching is rough. I can't imagine. Like, some of the Envy games, like, being as coach for some of those, I didn't have that many on Fnatic. But there's, like, some famous ones, like the DAC in 2015 where, like, they didn't have TPs to go back to base. Some Bone 7, no TP, suiciding with Aegis, trying to get back. There's a lot of those types of games. Like, that must be super stressful. And yeah, for me, it's always, I've never had stress issues inside the game in Dota. I felt like for myself, or pressure issues. Maybe I cause some stress for teammates or whatever, but as a coach, I have a lot of stress issues watching. So yeah.
Should this team have had a deeper run at TI?
Which team? The Fnatic team?
Yes.
I think some of the problems on that team just led the team to not being that good a team. Like, you can always have a deeper run at TI. How TI works is really weird, is sometimes you just end up scrimming the right team, or you're in the right groups with the right team. They teach you something about the game, and this idea carries you through the TI. Or you get lucky. Like, it's oftentimes, it's just luck. Like, everyone comes into TI, no one's played officials for a while, you all have your idea about the game, and you're just like, whose idea is correct? And sometimes your idea is correct. Sometimes another team's idea is correct. You're exposed to it. You can learn from it. Right. That TI, we weren't really exposed to enough ideas that were correct. We had some really good ideas coming in. I think I still pull some ideas that we use now from that team that we developed there. But somewhat unlucky, but also somewhat like the level of skill just ended up not being there. Or team synergy, cohesive, whatever you want to call it. So I don't think, even if the team went a bit further in TI, we didn't lose to the Shin Kyo team, I forget what they were called, Serenity. I don't think that team would have made a far run.
What you're talking about here is a couple of points I'd like to draw out a little bit, which is, as you're saying, this is actually a thing, funnily enough, that also happens in League of Legends at Worlds. And that, like, it's not as much in CSGO, because in CSGO, you play like a tournament every 2 or 3 weeks anyway, in theory, for your top team. So you always have your practice levels up, and it's the same teams. But actually, League of Legends is very similar, and I've noticed it to you. This is another reason, in my opinion, why the results always seem like, and sometimes it looks for real, dude. Like, if you don't follow the circuit much, it looks like someone just put the names in a hat and just pulled them out. Like, oh, who know? That team's third, it turns out. No one knew they were any good. Like, and you're like, what? And then the best team comes like ninth or whatever, isn't it? Like,
yeah. It was like that this year, right? With DRG. Like, no one thought they were going to come close to winning Worlds, and then they sort of just won.
DRX, yes, exactly. No, they were the massive underdog every single playoff round, put out with. Like, they were 14-1 underdog in the semis, like, to
really
win the tournament. And, like, if you wanted to do an outright bet on winning the whole tournament, yeah, exactly. So what I would say is, one thing I've found from behind the scenes is there's two factors at play. One is big tournaments that last a long time like this, like weeks and weeks and weeks, have obviously their own internal meta that becomes, like, strong, right? And as you say, it's not just that it happens, but you have to catch on to that quick. Like, you, before you get knocked out, obviously. And then part of how, as you said, it determines whether you do, is which scrim group you get into early on. So the problem is, if you come in, and you might even be with the other good teams if you're a top team, but maybe they don't end up being the good TI teams, as you're all practicing some shit that you all think works, and then it turns out the other scrim group has, like, the meta solved, us just wrecks everyone, right? It sounds like that alone makes it a lot of luck in the results.
No, for sure. Like, I think at TI5, there's a team called CDEC. They got second at TI that year. They defined the meta for that tournament. If they were in Secrets group, and, like, they were in our group that year, and we were also practice partners with them, but if they were in Secrets group, maybe Secret would have won that TI, because they taught everyone so much about Dota just by merit of being in their group. And, like, for example, like, this last TI, like, you had some weird Group A meta with, like, Shadow Fiend and these heroes that, like, went 0-10 on the main stage. And if you played into that meta, you thought it was good. You saw these teams like EG dominating the group stage. But then they played versus a Group B meta. And apparently, like, just sort of honestly by luck, like, Group B meta was just so much better. It just ended up dominating the tournament. I think, like, 3 of the top 4 teams were from Group B this year. Or, like, so I don't really know how to adjust for that. Like, just this luck factor. It's something that I think a lot about as coach. Like, because you can watch these strategies, you can watch these teams play, but you can't, like, have some empirical evidence, like, this is good, right? It's just like a gut feeling. It's like, oh, this looks good, what they do. At times, we were watching a shout, like, oh, this hero, like, maybe we should start playing it. But we decided, like, we scrimmed a bit, we decided, nah, I think this hero actually has some weaknesses we can expose instead. But we could have just been wrong about that, right? Like, there's a chance we just lost 0-4 of a Shadow Fiend in the main stage, and then, oh, GG, our TI runs over. We guessed wrong.
By the way, just as an aside, I actually just remembered as well that I think in the original interview we did of this, that I actually kept calling it champions instead of heroes, and that triggered you can imagine how
classic.
Like, oh, of course, and the fans were raging their tits off it. Whatever. I got it right this time, mate. It's all right. I've got it this
time. You know, I was actually thinking in interviews I did at TI in the future, I might start calling them champions.
Just to troll.
Just for fun. Yeah, just to see what happens. You know?
What happens. Like, exactly.
Just have some gamers having mental breakdowns. I think it's a good time.
Well, after this, you also then coached more, because you coached the forward gaming team, right? And this is a squad that people are going to know. It had the Resolution as the carry, and it had Universe in, it had MSS and SVG. So a bunch of people that you've played with actually in the past of your career. Like, most of these people you've either coached or played with, right? At this point in your career, what was it like, the logic of, like, I'll coach when I don't have a team that's, like, vaguely good enough? Or were you always hoping, like, I'm going to go back to playing at some point? Or were you, like, thinking if it goes well in coaching, I just become permanent coach? Like, this seems like this was the period where, like, you were still deciding, right?
So for me personally, I struggle with some, like, arm issues from playing too much already by this point. Honestly, like, it sort of was my entire career since I played StarCraft. Like, I've had some wrist issues or, like, forearm issues, and I think at that time, I felt like coaching was really rewarding and entertaining, and that was mostly what I was looking for. Like, I was looking more for, like, I didn't, also maybe because I didn't have this, but I didn't feel like the insane drive that I felt from other players to, like, win TI. Like, I don't think I had that at that time. Maybe it was, like, burnout. Like, as I said before, like, I never really took any breaks, so I wasn't, like, able to build up that mental momentum that I think you need to be a player. And I thought coaching was, like, something where you could develop yourself as a human. I mentioned, like, it's something I was sort of interested in. Like, I want to become a more round person. And it was just, like, something new that was seemed really interesting while still giving, like, a lot of the highs of playing still, right? I think it's something that happens in esports a lot. It's like after you finish in esports, like you go back to a regular job or something and like, ah, this is sort of shit, you know, like I don't like it.
Yes.
So at that time I was looking at coaching full time. And I think that was one of the things, like after the TI7 was over, like I talked to SVG. He was like, yeah, you can coach us. We're going to get Universe. And I coached him in Fnatic and it seemed like a good idea. So I went to coach them.
In this particular team, this is another one where like these aren't bad players on paper. In fact, some of them are very good players at certain points. It's just that this isn't the best period in their career. So like, was there some sort of a chemistry flaw in this? Because I noticed in this team, actually, I was a bit shocked when I went back. Like, I remember it being all right. I was a bit shocked that you like, you never had any top four finishes. It was all just like 7th to 8th. Like, it's kind of a bit whatever, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think the performance of the team was very poor. I think I wasn't the best coach, but honestly, I think the team had a lot of synergy issues. I think the three core players, none of them were really like vocal and made calls. I think the meta around that time was like you needed these cores that made calls for your team. Was that TI8? That was TI8, yeah. So TI7 just finished. You had like Liquid who had Matu who called a lot. And you'd have like all these cores like Ramzes. I think VP was the strongest team that year. Ramzes, no one would lead the games. And you wanted, like, after a certain point in the game, you needed your cores to make these calls because it's just like your perspective as a core is very different as a support. You know when you are strong a lot better and how to use these picks. It's the same in, like, modern day Dota. And back then, I think we were just sort of behind the meta in terms of how we communicated and made calls. And our supports, honestly, they weren't the most vocal either. So it's just like a very quiet team where not that much happened. And because of that, like no one was able to play up to their true potential. It wasn't like a captaincy issue. I think even to this day, I think SVG is the best captain I've seen outside the game. But like in game, you just didn't have enough shot callers. And you can't make a team without shot callers like that.
By the way, just as an aside, since you brought them up, how are you also someone who looks at like the Virtus Pro team as like, how did they not win TI? Because it was like a couple of years where I used to explain to people who aren't Dota fans, like they genuinely were like the best team, except like TI Day 4 or whatever the fuck it was, where you need to start winning the matches. Like, it's ridiculous how like TI was the only tournament they seemed to bomb, right?
Yeah, that team was, they were the best Dota team, I think. Like, you would learn everything from them, you would want to watch them, how they took the map was insane. They're super aggressive. I think Ramzes and no one were by far the best core duo in the game. And it's not like the other players were bad or anything. It's just those two were so good. And it's just how TI is. Like, I don't know. Like, it's the same at TI10. Like, you had this VP team who has dominated the entire year. They stomped Spirit every single game. And Spirit beat them at TI10 and the entire tournament. It's just how it goes in Dota. And it's weird because everything in Dota is about TI. And everything about this one tournament, but still just one tournament. Like, this is actually something that we said to ourselves after TI 11. Was like, we won TI, but like, why should we think we're good? Like, don't think you're good. The reason we won is we put in hard work, and we won one tournament, guys. Like, is this really that different than winning some ESL Malaysia or whatever tournament? Like, you happen to be lucky that the tournament you won was TI, right? So, just, I don't know what it is about TI. It's the pressure, luck, whatever factors go in, but just makes this tournament like very unique in that sense.
Right. Being as you played with him, admittedly, he wasn't the one position at that time, and you obviously coached him when he was in this particular team. How do you explain who Resolution is as a player? Because he's someone where there's been times at his peak, he has looked fucking amazing. Obviously, he's had some amazing results. He's had an up and down career himself.
I describe Rezo. Honestly, it's hard for me to describe Rezo. Like, he's really high skill. I think that's, but it's like, it's so generic, right? Like, I don't know how to describe him other than that.
Like, he's like some really high skill player. How should you use this guy if to get the best out of him, do you think?
I see. I mean, I don't know how he's evolved over the years, but like, when I first worked with him on DC, he was super open to learning, and I think that was his strength. Like, he's really talented and smart, so like, when you present him with an idea, he's really quick to pick up on it. His English back then actually wasn't the best, but even with that barrier, like, he was still really fast at learning things and improving. And then when I worked on him with Ford, I think it was like still somewhat the same. Like, he was really high skilled. He was able to learn these ideas. One of the problems we actually had on Ford was that I was too strong with some ideas. Like, there's some concepts around like how you play the map, and I'll talk about them, and Rezo would start talking to them sort of like how I describe Envy talking about stuff. like he would be playing a different part of the map and he would still be trying to coordinate stuff around the mid lane, for example. And this would lead to his own play falling off, and that was because like he has like a lot of faith in other people's ideas and trying to implement them, and I really appreciate about that about him as a player. Because you want some of that, right? I just needed to do a better job as coach of like monitoring it, assigning roles to people in the game, like, oh, you don't need to talk about this when you're over here. This is this guy's job. You guys just need to come up with like a default, like, you know, in like Counter-Strike, you have like these defaults on maps. Like, honestly, in Dota, a lot of it, you decide your default on the map, like who's going to play where the same way. And we didn't really have that on Forward Gaming. Instead, like, everyone would be trying to coin these things. And it sort of amplified the fact that we didn't have as much shot calling because we're focusing on some small things when we need to make
a big... As in the game, you just figured out. Like, you didn't go in like, well, from this draft that we're probably going to play through these lanes and we'll try and help you. Like, you didn't have like a game plan at the beginning?
I think that's rare in Dota because the game's really dynamic. But basically, like, you establish default understandings where everyone, like, this is what we will usually do in a game. This type of hero will play on this part of the map. This type of hero will play here with him. We want vision around these areas. And when you have these defaults, it makes it very easy to make changes because everyone comes from the same page. So once you say one change to the default, you're able to say like, oh, I want to actually do this instead. And so, okay, I'll pick up where you were doing before because they already know what you're doing. But generally, it's not like some, you do the draft like, oh, this is what we're going to do at minute like 9 or something. I think that's very hard to do because like I can say what I think should happen, but you can't know for sure. For example, as I mentioned before, like you have some level 1 fight. The game has changed. Are you really going to want to make the same rotation? Maybe you want to make a rotation earlier because you see an opportunity. Maybe you want to make it later. Even if the rotation still happens, how you're going to do it should be based on the in-game information that you get rather than like some outside of game.
Because maybe this addresses then one of the things I've always thought was one of the interesting, unique elements of Dota from watching it as an outsider who's watched a lot of other esports games. In some of the other esports games, I will say, I actually think they all share some element of this, but in some other esports games, really, if you do just have the best player, that is like the best building piece to win the game with. Like, you get them doing their shit, you sort of like set them up, and then it's like you put pieces around them, right? But I've noticed in Dota, I mean, the best example obviously is Poppy, like you said earlier. If you look in Dota, the people with the most enduring success are just all the captains, and usually it's like the hard fucking 5 position guy who's just some boomer who's played like 20 years of Dota. And so that makes me wonder, like, if, along with what you're saying here, I mean, it has to be the shot calling, right? Like, they almost make it look, I know it isn't as simple as this, you really do need like fucking godlike players like Nisha and Arteezy and stuff, but they do make it look almost like, I know back in the day, like Eternal Envy thought, like, you can just go and get some AK guy out of fucking, and just have him play the one position, he knows how to hit creeps. Like, that was the perception, but it's sort of true in a way, right? The shot calling captains are the most influential players, right?
I think at this point, Dota, there is some element of shot calling in the game. But I think a lot of it is about how you build your team defaults / ideas. Like, so like these captains, because Dota's so caged off, they have, maybe it's good for them that it's so caged off, right? Because they have like these certain ideas or ways to communicate or ideas about how they would like their team to play that just consistently lead to success. And you just don't really know what it is. Like for me, like as an outsider looking, like I don't know exactly what Puppy does on Secret that has led him to be so successful so many times over the years. Same with like Kuro, Enigma, or whatever these legendary captains. We have a bit more exposure to like Seven No-Tail because of Truesight, but they could be doing something completely different or opposite. We wouldn't know, but it's still leading to success, right? And yeah, you need that on a team. You need a cohesive team identity. You can't have people always with conflicting ideas trying to do different things on the map. It just won't work for Dota.
I mean, since you played with him, I always thought PPD was definitely in that group of people. Like, you look at you can change a lot of players in his teams and they're still having a lot of success. It's funny because I always used to hear from players like, he's a fucking asshole. It's like, mate, he might be an asshole in the right ways, though, in the game, though. It seemed like he always put his vision on the game, right?
I think for sure. Like, I think what PPD was really good at was, organizing his team's thoughts into, like, a cohesive strategy. Like, I think, for example, on TI5, I think the person who did most shot calling was actually Fear. I think that remained pretty consistent with EG. But what PPD would do is, like, he was really good at, like, affirming when, like, he was really good at backing up when a call is right, as well as making his own really good calls, right? But, like, I think the most, like, calls I remember from at TI5 is, like, he would tell us when he thought a fight was good or bad. And we would all play off that. And we would just have this cohesive idea of, like, how we were supposed to play this based on if the fight was good or bad. And that was really useful, right? Like, we'd drag them in. Oh, now the fight's good. Sometimes they'd be like, yo, we need to run. And then they'd cross the line and just, oh, the fight's good. Turn. and then we would all just do it, right? And that's really important. So I think it's the same, yeah, for PPD, Puppy, Curl, whoever else. Like, they probably have some elements of this. I just don't really know what they are.
Another thing as well you make me think of when you said some of the past teams, I noticed you said some of them didn't have enough shot callers, like plural. So there's another thing I think. I noticed when people have discussions, they make it too reductive. They either make it if they're very naive, like all five players are just geniuses and can just figure out, which is almost never the case. Or they just make it like the movie version, which is like, it's just all Jouet and PPD and fucking Puppy, right? I've always got the vibe as well. A lot of really great teams is like, you want a captain like that. But then as you say, you maybe want some other guy who has his own vision and he's like the secondary caller sometimes. Or like in this case, he either, because some teams it's more like, we could do this. And then you need the guy to go, yes, let's do it now. That's part of the action. Or sometimes you need the counter call, right? Like, no, don't, let's do this instead. And if that's the trusted guy, that's sometimes the one play you need in a game, right?
Yeah, I think as Dota's evolved, there's a lot more, like, I don't think there are any silent players. Before, you'd have a lot of players who are really quiet and they would just do their thing. Honestly, like, Sumail at TI5, he didn't really make many calls. He's a really quiet kid, you know, 16 years old, came in, outskilled everyone, did his own thing. But I think even now, like, Sumail makes a lot of calls. When I play with him in pubs and stuff, he'll make calls. And for our team, like, everyone will make calls based on when they think they're supposed to make calls. Because the thing about Dota is each role and hero is so, like, different in what you're doing in the game and your strengths that you need to make calls based on what your power spikes are and what you're able to lead. So, for example, like, one thing that we have is, like, if we're going to start a fight, everyone needs to shut up except for the people who are initiating. And I think it clears up our communication a lot, because right now, even though they might be lower net worth, they are the strongest hero on our team because they're the ones who are deciding when the fight's going to start. And at other times, when our carry, when Skitter hits his timing or something, everyone shuts up and listens to Skitter. Or in the early game, Yosne wants to call some rotations. So it just changes based on what we think the best calls to make, or whoever's in the best position to make these calls. And I think that's just how Dota is now. I don't think there's ever... I don't even know if there ever was a team where one person just made all the calls. I don't know where the narrative came from, but it was never really like that in Dota. And I don't think it can be like that, because it's just way too hard to manage so many things with limited info.
Yes. Okay, what about... this is actually in the story when you then made the Fighting Pandas, later Crazy Team. Where, funnily enough, again, it's like different players all from your past is coming back. So it's like Eternal Envy comes back, Bryal and Moonmeander there, Snake King comes in. Like, this seems like another team where... like, at this point in your career, like you said it earlier, like, it seems like, look, because you don't have the craziest stock, you're not being headhunted by all the biggest teams. Seems like the main priority in these teams is people you want to play with, people you already know, right? You have a sense of how the team might work, right?
Yeah, no, I think it's also just how I talk to people in Dota. Like, as I mentioned before, I don't talk to that many people outside my team. So that team, actually, like, I coached Snakey on Newbie, and he got kicked after the tournament, I think. So I decided to go play with him. I think one thing before this team I want to mention is, like, when I coached Newbie, like, we went to TI, we had a roster switch where Universe and SVG retired, Universe and Resolution left. And it was just Yawar, MSS, and me. And then we brought in, like, CCNC, Ketrak, and Snake. So when we went to that TI, I think that was actually the TI where I think a team that I coached should have made a deeper run. Like, we made winner bracket. We lost to OG, as is tradition for snaking back then. And I actually sort of failed as a coach back then. Because, like, when we were in the loser bracket, like, I didn't really know what to say to my team after we lost the game to Beast Coast or whatever. So, like, actually, until this TI 11, I hadn't won a series on the main stage at TI as a coach, which is sort of embarrassing because I went to a bunch of them.
Sure.
But like, so after that team, like, they made roster changes and they wanted me to keep coaching, but I felt like I shouldn't keep coaching because I didn't think I was that good a coach. I want to get some more experience. And we made this team with, like, Snay, Envy, me, Moonbrow, as you said. And honestly, that team, like, the expectations weren't insanely high going in because a lot of our stocks were just not that high. But I think I learned a lot on that team as well. Like, Moon's, like, all the players are really smart on that team, and Brow is like a up and coming star. I don't want to say it wasn't like a serious team, but it wasn't like the as full committal, I think, as like, we didn't have a sponsor or anything, right? So we didn't really have boot camps and stuff like that. It wasn't as full committal as a lot of the past team I've been on. Yeah.
What about this then? So when you came back to playing in this team, give me that angle then. Like, you made this team with these players, like, this is really like the last real run. This is like, if this one doesn't work, it's coaching, right? Which it did become.
Yeah, I think it was sort of like that. I mean, This was like the first team I wanted to try captain, because I'd never really been a captain before that. And I was playing like position five, but it just ended up not working out. Like, I said, it wasn't as serious as other teams I've been on, but I think like the approach was not on the same level from all the players. I think some people wanted to be super serious, some people weren't as serious. And for myself, like I really wanted to be like a grow as a captain sort of thing into making a good team. But I think the expectations were like people wanted to. I personally didn't have enough time to develop as a captain. But I think it got taken over sort of quick. Not like in a negative intention way, but just like, oh, you're lacking a bit here. Let me help you make up for it by doing this. And then we, instead of like having me grow into that, we started end up relying on the other person to cover it. Because like I think, for example, like Moon was really good at a lot of things in the draft and like stuff like this. And honestly, like he should have just been the captain from the start. Like we would have had more success. But we didn't end up doing that, and it didn't end up being that good project.
One of the things you're talking about here is something I've also noticed, and I can tell you in Counter-Strike, this is a massive quality, which is, it's another game where the legendary captains, they do just have insane like longevity to their careers. And there's a reason why people don't have like 1 or 2 years good as a captain and then not be a captain. It's like I've noticed when people take that role on, like oftentimes it's people like you, people who've been like, they play like support or something or some role where it's like, look, I think I have like an idea of what I'm doing here. But I've noticed the problem is like you're saying, it's like you don't get the time. Like the guys who've done it a long time, they've got like 10 years of experience, like they've been through every up and down. And so I've noticed what the trend happens tends to be when people swap to that role, unless it just is amazing out of the gate, a few months in, they just quit. It's like, cause I always say this, everyone dreams of being the captain when you're making like the good call and everything's going awesome. No one likes it when you have like 3 tournaments in a row where it's just shit and you make the wrong call, you don't know what you're doing, and you didn't have control over the team. Like that's when you just think like, fuck, just let someone else do it. Like it's kind of a role, right? You have to commit. You have to be willing to basically like, this might take 3 years to get good at.
Yeah, I think you have to commit, and you also have to have like a personality for it. Like you have to like, oh, it doesn't matter what they think, I'm the captain. Like this is what we're going to do. Like you have to have the strength.
And will I think, you not like that? Personally,
I don't think so.
You seem a bit too amiable, if you know what I mean. Like you don't see that you put your foot down enough.
I mean, it's also like there's a lot of responsibilities that you sort of need to take on as captain. Like, for example, for us on Snaze captain, and like, he's really good. Like, even if we start losing, he can just, you know, like, shove his feelings into a box and try to make the team feel better sort of thing.
Okay.
Like, I don't think I'm that good at that, but it's important to have that on a team, like, just to rally the team, right? It's probably like the biggest thing I was lacking as a coach on the newbie team that I talked to. But yeah. No, it's hard. Captain's hard. Like, it's not even like the in-game Dota calls. I think mostly it's like how you would need to build the team, like consider how everyone's perspective and feelings combined into idea. It's not an easy role for sure.
I've also heard the element that like, obviously no one sees this unless they do like a true sight thing or whatever. It sounds like one of the trickiest parts is just like man management. It's like what you do with the players outside the server. Like, and everyone thinks as well when they're watching like those shows, they all think it's a movie and like every captain's given some epic speech. I've actually found, dude, in history, it's like, it's actually, you've got to do that, but you've got to do it really sparingly. Like you've got to know like the moment when you've got the good speech. Like if you do it, cause I've known some captains who were good captains, but they did it every time. Like every fucking one was like the any given Sunday, like, guys, we can do this, and if we are, but it's like if you do that every time, it means nothing. But at the same time, if you never do it, you won't have your team emotionally in the right position. It sounds like a very tricky role, mate.
Yeah, for sure. And what you mentioned with the speech, like it is an important tool, I think, right? But as you said, like you have to know when to do it. Like if everyone's feeling good going into a game, like why are you making a speech, right?
Yes,
so I feel
exactly.
Like they probably did it, right? Like they did it, and people are like, oh, why am I listening to this? And probably drags the mood down because you know it's like so forced, right?
Yes.
So, all right, yeah,
that's the other thing. If it feels fake, I feel like that kills it. Like if people sort of know, oh, he's doing like a movie thing where he thinks if we win, this will be a cool story. That doesn't work. It's like it has to be real as well. Like, you have to really, because I've always thought the most underrated angle is the guy where they don't often give a speech, but they give like the one fucking statement before a big game. You're like, holy shit, if he's saying it, like, wow.
Then we actually had TI with Saxa. Like we were not performing well, and like, he had to give us a couple of speeches during the bootcamp in TI, and they were really good, because when he talks, you just shut up and listen. Like, he doesn't usually talk that much like that, so you know it's important when he's saying it, right? He's thought of it, he's, like, been thinking about it, and then he gives it, and you're like, oh, wow. And he just happens to be correct a lot of the time, so just trust the guy.
Money doesn't grow on trees, and believe it or not, just watching a video for free with the odd ad doesn't really pay the bills. So thanks to the following people for kindly supporting my work and this particular content. And those people are, of course, Ahmed Haju, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Animosity, ButtPounder420, Jensen Gore, Kovacevic, Tobias Bernasconi, Tosh, Toucan, and a special thanks always goes out to Jerky's Minion, my main man. You know what? There are plenty of perks to be found on my Patreon, like you can find out who upcoming guests are for my reflections, interviews and talk shows. You can ask me a question in my monthly AMA. Might get roasted if it's a bit spicy in how you phrase it. You can figure out which pieces of content I might want to do next. I often ask people which they think between certain ideas, offer suggestions. You can even take part in one of those long discussions with me about all kinds of esports, whatever's on your mind. So if any of those sound like something that takes your fancy, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Scrumminati today via the Patreon link in the description below.